Hello, and welcome to Distillations, weekly extracts from the past, present, and future of chemistry. I'm Robert Hicks. Each week, we bring you stories on all things chemical, from atoms to alarm clocks. In this week's show, we're taking you through a brief history of time, chemistry style. We'll learn how a hand-me-down appliance is saving time in a modern-day kitchen, and visit the National Institute of Standards and Technology, where timekeeping is done on the atomic level. That's all coming up on today's episode of Distillations. Time is one of science's fundamental quantities, along with mass, length, and temperature. They're called fundamental quantities because all other units of measurement, like speed, acceleration, momentum, and energy, can be derived from them. Velocity, for instance, is calculated as distance divided by time. But distance and time can't be broken down any further. Philosophers have debated for centuries whether time actually exists, or if it's a concept we created to make sense of the world. But whether it's real or not, time orders our lives. One could argue that the basis for scientific and engineering research is controlling the sequences of events through time, speeding them up, slowing them down, or in some cases, stopping the process of entropy altogether. For chemists, catalysts are some of the most important tools in the timing of chemical reactions. Jennifer Dionisio has more about a relatively new time-saving catalyst in today's Element of the Week.
Unless you're a chemical engineer, you probably haven't heard of ruthenium. It's a transition metal in the middle of the periodic table, and in many ways it's fairly unremarkable. But over the past 15 years, ruthenium has become increasingly important as a catalyst in an organic chemistry reaction known as olefin metathesis. Olefins are simply hydrocarbon compounds that contain a double bond. In olefin metathesis, two different hydrocarbons switch functional groups, sort of like a molecular dance in which couples change partners. This ultimately leads to fewer byproducts and therefore less chemical waste, but it's nearly impossible without a catalyst. Catalysts are substances that make chemical reactions go faster by decreasing the activation energy associated with the reaction. Although they work in a variety of ways, the basic idea is that catalysts provide an easier pathway between reactants and the finished product. With ruthenium, hydrocarbons are thought to bind to the metal to form a temporary ring structure that then breaks apart to form a different molecule. Although a number of transition metals, like nickel, tungsten, and molybdenum, can act as catalysts for this reaction, ruthenium catalysts are the most stable and offer greater selectivity. Caltech chemist Robert Grubbs, along with Richard Schrock and Yves Chauvin, won the Nobel Prize for this discovery in 2005, and manufacturers have since used ruthenium catalysts to make pharmaceuticals, plastics, and other materials in fewer steps with less energy. This not only reduces the manufacturer's environmental impact, but it also helps out with another important part of manufacturing, the bottom line. In chemical engineering, faster usually means cheaper, and as the saying goes, time is money. And that's it for the Element of the Week. I'm Jennifer Dionisio.
Jennifer Dionisio is Program Coordinator for Biotechnology at the Chemical Heritage Foundation's Center for Contemporary History and Policy. You can learn more about how catalysts are making green chemistry possible in the summer issue of Chemical Heritage Magazine. Check it out online at chemheritage.org/magazine. One place where it seems we're always trying to beat time is in the kitchen. Microwaves are an obvious time saver, but Distillations executive producer Audra Wolf has recently been experimenting with an older time-saving device, the pressure cooker. She has more in today's Chemistry in Your Cupboard.
That sound you're hearing is my jiggle-top pressure cooker. It used to be my grandmother's, but I brought it home with me over the Christmas holiday. I was dubious at first, but now I'm hooked. It turns out the stories of explosions are greatly exaggerated, but the claims about dramatically reduced cooking times are true. I started with a batch of chickpeas. 15 minutes and they were falling apart, completely overcooked. If you've ever tried cooking dried chickpeas, you'll know why I was so shocked. I'm using it all the time now, for dried beans, brown rice, pot roast, I even canned chicken stock in it. Although the name pressure cooker wasn't introduced until 1915, the concept of cooking foods under pressure has been around since the 17th century, when the French physicist Denis Papin demonstrated his steam digester before the Royal Society. The scientific concept behind pressure cooking has remained pretty much unchanged since then, with most of the innovations coming from the introduction of safety measures, like locks and safety valves. The appliance depends on two key scientific concepts, phase change and, if you've been listening to this show for a while, this may sound familiar, the ideal gas law. Once a liquid starts boiling, it will stay at the same temperature until the phase change is complete, which means that water will never rise above 212 degrees Fahrenheit in an open pot at sea level. But if the pot is closed, the water vapor can't escape. As more water vapor is produced, the pressure increases. And since the pressure increases, but the volume stays the same, the temperature rises. The liquid contents of a typical pressure cooker operating under 15 pounds of pressure will reach 257 degrees Fahrenheit, hot enough to kill most bacteria in canned goods, and hot enough to cook most foods very, very quickly. And that's today's Chemistry in Your Cupboard. I'm Audra Wolf.
Have comments or questions about something you've heard on our show? Send your thoughts to distillations@chemheritage.org. You're listening to Distillations. I'm Robert Hicks. Finally today, timekeeping has come a long way since the days of sundials and pendulums, and today's timekeepers are accurate to many billionths of a second. Producer Eric Mack has more from the National Institute of Standards and Technology.
Sitting on a table in a small, windowless room in Boulder, Colorado, there's a machine that helps keep much of our modern civilization running on time.
We're in a room that's about 20 by 20, and the equipment is pretty much filling this room.
That's Tom O'Brien. He heads up the Time and Frequency Division at the National Institute of Standards and Technology. Today, he's giving me the very brief tour of NIST 1, the world's most accurate atomic clock. Basically a big aluminum tube surrounded by a variety of lenses, cables, and other electronic equipment. O'Brien gives me the short version of what's going on inside that tube to get such an accurate measurement.
We make a ball of cesium atoms, and then we toss them straight up. They move through the microwave chamber, but each time we toss the ball, we change the frequency very slightly until we get the frequency that gives the best absorption.
Sounds simple, right? Well, maybe if you're one of the two PhDs it takes to operate it. Here's a couple ground rules to remember. First, when he's talking about microwaves and absorption, he's really describing a way to observe and count the vibrations of an atom. It's kind of like tuning a radio to the right frequency or set of vibrations. And that brings us to the second rule, which is that all atoms vibrate, including the quartz crystals in your old wristwatch. But five different quartz crystals might vibrate at five different frequencies. So quartz was out when it came time to build a standardized atomic clock, and cesium was in. O'Brien explains one of the reasons why.
Every cesium atom anywhere in the universe, so far as we know, is going to vibrate at the same set of frequencies. Every cesium atom has a set of vibrations, and one of those vibrations is the standard. And it's called the hyperfine transition in cesium, and it's defined as 9,192,631,770 vibrations per second. Now, that's a definition. That means that if you want to count up those 9 billion, et cetera, vibrations, and you have realized the second. You have measured exactly 1 second by international agreement.
Counting up all those billions of vibrations creates a clock so accurate it takes more than 80 million years to become off by even a single second. I asked O'Brien why anyone would need a clock so precise.
When you flip on the light switch, you're tapping into a grid of more than 10,000 generating stations, all of which need to be synchronized to each other better than a millionth of a second per day. The global positioning system. That's a system of satellites orbiting. Each of them has an atomic clock on it, and they're constantly sending out a radio signal. Those signals, radio waves, travel at the speed of light, which is roughly 1 foot in a billionth of a second. So if you want to be able to find your position anywhere on the surface of the Earth, you need to be able to do timing much better than a billionth of a second.
The atomic clock's technology is exponentially more accurate than the old gears on your watch or the algorithms that run your digital alarm clock. But when I ask O'Brien if I might ever wear an atomic clock around my wrist, he pulls something out of his pocket that looks a little bit like a golden grain of rice mounted on a microchip.
This chip-scale atomic clock runs for a few days on a AA battery. You can see it's teeny tiny, it's the size of a grain of rice. Because it is made using standard semiconductor fabrication technology, in principle, you can imagine these things being mass-produced. There are many companies already that are trying to take this technology that has been developed at NIST and other places and turn them into commercial products. And I'm confident that they will succeed at that.
O'Brien says it might be a little while before the technology becomes affordable enough to be the next Swatch or Casio, but it's already being put to other uses. The same technology that allows the atomic clock to keep time so precisely can also be applied to measure things like magnetic fields. and O'Brien's unit is working on a quantum clock with groundbreaking technology that could change the way we live all over again by helping to make computing, information sharing, and of course, timekeeping infinitely more powerful. For Distillations, I'm Eric Mack.
Eric Mack is a producer based in northern New Mexico. You can see pictures and learn more about the atomic clock on our website, distillations.chemheritage.org. And that's it for this week's episode of Distillations. Today's quotation comes from William Faulkner's classic novel, The Sound and the Fury. Clocks slay time. Time is dead as long as it is being clicked off by little wheels. Only when the clock stops does time come to life. Distillations is a presentation of the Chemical Heritage Foundation and is made possible by the generous support of the Richard Lounsbery Foundation. Mia Lobel is our senior producer. Our assistant producer is Victoria Indeviro, and our executive producer is Audra Wolf. Our theme music is composed and performed by Dave Kaufman. Additional music provided from the PodSafe Music Network. Check it out at music.podshow.com. Please tell us what you think about our program and send suggestions for future shows to distillations@chemheritage.org. Until next time, I'm Robert Hicks.